A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
I think a lot of people love the fact that they can make this really specific, tangible impact, and they can do it along with the thousand other things that they're doing in their day just by making a particular choice of what and who they buy from.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, the show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. On the podcast, we are opening up the critical conversation around childhood poverty and hunger that, quite frankly, I'm embarrassed to have to be talking about in 2021. But rather than complaining or pointing out a desperate situation, I really want to shine a light on some incredible initiatives. And on that note, I want you to ponder this. Can we use hunger to end hunger? This is the simple, revolutionary formula that my next guest and his colleagues founded over 10 years ago. Owen Burton co-founded One Feeds Two, a charitable organization that partners with food brands and work to provide school meals to children living in poverty across the globe. And the process is painstakingly simple. They partner with relevant organizations, and that could be as different as small food brands or even a nationwide burger chain restaurant. They license their logo, and the partner offers to give one school meal per meal that they sell. The partnership launches every 4 weeks. The partner will send them a number of how many meals that they have offered to donate. They send them an invoice, and then the money goes to One Feeds Two, and they partner with free school meal initiatives across the globe who they fund. It is that simple. It is incredible that One Feeds Two partners have now donated over 10 million school meals. And in 2021 alone, they hope to donate over 6 million school meals. The meals are locally sourced, largely plant-based and typical of the local cuisine, whether that be as far-reaching as somewhere in Malawi. And they try and ask themselves the question, what the kids would be eating if they were eating at home. One Feeds Two partners with different sorts of food companies to help them make this happen. And they've recently partnered with other people in the UK and the USA as well. On the show today, we talk about Owen's travel and corporate background, the early foundations of One Feeds Two, why school meals are magical, and the impact on poverty, but also educational attainment, what we can learn from One Feeds Two as it relates to childhood poverty in the UK. And we also talk about Owen's current projects as an entrepreneur and his new drinks brand, Fount. I think you're going to love this episode. Hopefully you find it inspiring. And if you are thinking about initiatives, then do go check out One Feeds Two. It's an incredible, simple formula that is having massive impact across the globe, and I think we can all learn from it. Owen, thank you so much for coming on the pod. I am super excited to get into the incredible business that you've created, the initiative, where it came from. But I just wanted to ask, how are you doing at the moment?
Yeah, we're good. Thanks, Rupi. Thanks very much for having us to talk to you today.
Definitely. So One Feeds Two, this is an incredible organization that's been going on for a long time. But I feel right now we're at a moment where it's become even more of an issue that a lot of people have become aware of. And I think the pandemic has really put a spotlight on child hunger. I know your organization is focused perhaps slightly further away from home, but I think the ethos of the company that you created is something that we could all learn a bit about. What I wanted to go into before we get into One Feeds Two actually is a bit about you and what your foundational years were like and how that might have influenced your aspirations and bringing this initiative to fruition.
Yeah, so I was born in Zimbabwe did most of my preschooling in South Africa. I've still got lots of family in South Africa. High school and university, early career days were all in Australia. And I guess very lucky in that I had some opportunities to travel. Through Southeast Asia, I did that as a university student. I spent a few summers in Vietnam on an overseas study program, which was designed around work experience, aid work, and English teaching. Essentially a kid from country New South Wales in Australia, being deposited in Hanoi. Just wonderful, colourful, flavourful experience. Gives me goosebumps. You know, it's now amazingly 20 odd years on. Saw a lot of the developing world in inverted commas through some of those experiences. And then I've been really lucky. I after university went into management consulting, and some of my project work took me to incredible places like India and Singapore. You know, being based in Singapore and doing projects across Asia, and just kind of seeing this wonderful variety of different countries, from some really poor countries through to, you know, the most developed, and all the colour that comes with all of that. That's kind of some of the background. I don't know that I've ever sort of explicitly joined the dots on any of those particular life experiences and thought, well, that's why One Feeds Two should exist and is worth the time and effort in kind of building it out, but it's got to be. And I guess when you travel to all those places, the kids are such a visible part of the landscape, and there are always opportunities to kind of interact, and they're things that resonate and kind of stick with you as well. So
definitely,
I think that actually, you know, when you then start talking about, well, there are kids, and there are kids that don't go to school, and there are kids that go to school hungry, you kind of think, well, if there's something you can do to nudge things forward and help out, it's kind of quite exciting and certainly something that kind of, grabbed me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to go back to why I struggled to figure out your accent, I kind of understand now, given that you were born in Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Australia, and a lot of people get the two mixed and conflated, and usually I'm like, no, there's a huge difference between the South African accent, an Aussie accent, a New Zealand accent, you know, but now I can sort of see the twangs in all those different elements of your upbringing. And I definitely get that about Hanoi in particular. I had the wonderful opportunity to go to Hanoi just after I qualified as a medic in 2008, 2009. It was incredible country. I think at that point it had become a bit touristy. It was, I mean, it's probably, I mean, obviously not right now, but in the last couple of years, it's definitely getting even more so. But perhaps when you were there, it was perhaps a little bit more genuine in terms of its rawness and the colors and everything else. And just while you were talking there, I know we're in the middle of a pandemic, we're all in our own houses, and we're talking about travel and stuff, and it just evokes so many good memories of traveling in between university years and stuff, and actually seeing those different experiences. I can imagine, particularly being in Southeast Asia where the kids are playing outside or, you know, working, helping their parents. A lot of the families are subsistence farming or in agriculture, which is quite low paid. Perhaps that may have planted the seeds in why you started One Feast Two in the first place. But to go a little bit after your sort of your educational years, What were your early careers like in your early 20s?
So I guess it was sort of the consulting lifestyle of quite a lot of travel, sort of quite intense work hours, endless amounts of researching whichever industry you happen to be working on or the nuances of a business within a particular market. Yeah, and it was at that point in time I was based in Sydney in Australia, which is just an incredible place to be. So life was quite good when it wasn't work, as of, you know, lots of beach and, you know, great bars and restaurants and you know, weekends away with groups of friends to various beaches or vineyards and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I loved my time in Sydney. It was amazing. I was there for 2 years, and I was based just outside Manly. And you can imagine with a bunch of medics, it was probably quite similar to your experience with your consultant friends and stuff. And you'd do weekends away to like Seal Rock and Hunter Valley, and we went to Margaret River as well. A bunch of us. You always have like a group of friends to do stuff with because everyone's just excited and wants to explore.
And actually through what my experience was working with, you know, the Brits who had come for a year or two to sort of live and live abroad and do some travel, you know, it didn't matter what it was, they were always up for it as well. And an Aussie, you know, sometimes you can become a little bit complacent of all those great things that are on your doorstep, and you kind of think that you'll kind of get to some of those good things eventually. But actually, yeah, it was one of the things I was very fortunate to have was a great group, many of whom sort of fitted that profile of, you know, we're here for 2 years, so, you know, if we don't go and see X tomorrow night, we might not get to do it. So, you know, lock it in and sort of seize the day.
Definitely. And I think that, you know, attitude of learning and trying to enjoy a lot more of what's on your doorstep is sort of now something I'm trying to practice during lockdown. I mean, yeah, we can only go to the park, but a lot of people don't actually have parks around them to enjoy. And, you know, when lockdown restrictions ease a bit and perhaps we won't be able to travel internationally, there are so many places in the UK that I really want to go to and experience. And I've been looking through all the different pictures and stuff. And so, you know, wherever you are in the world, wherever you're listening to this, there are some incredible spots of beauty that we should start appreciating a bit more. But I wanted to get to around those consultancy years. And I've got a couple of my friends who are consultants, and And that really does resonate with me in terms of the lifestyle of long hours and learning something completely new of a new industry and presentations and all the rest of it. When do you remember the idea of One Feeds 2 sort of popping into your head? What were the early sort of seedlings of that?
So I guess the backstory to One Feeds 2 is that in 2010, I did a project in Johannesburg, and it was working for the not-for-profit of the Virgin Group called Virgin Unite, and they had have a centre of entrepreneurship based in Johannesburg at the time, and it was the basic premise for the centre was you know, somewhere that could support young entrepreneurs, really micro level businesses. Help them get started, help them become sustainable with a backdrop that was actually, it's quite unlikely that the economy can grow quickly enough to provide enough sort of corporate style jobs for the population. And so actually, you know, entrepreneurship was and still is a really important aspect of economic development and kind of progressing the quality of life and delivering some of the improvements that people are looking for. It was an amazing 8 or 9 months. Like, just met incredible personalities, particularly amongst the entrepreneurs, but we were also very lucky that we had sort of the benefit of the Virgin network. And so we had lots of established international entrepreneurs who'd come through and visit the centre. They'd want to spend time sounding out some of the young entrepreneurs, giving them ideas. Some of them went on to mentor. And actually one of the people doing that was a guy called Mark Christophers. And he had set up and at that point in time recently sold the West Cornwall Pasty Company. So he'd been in the food industry. Mm-hmm. He'd been very successful. And he put a lot of time and effort into the centre, spent a lot of time with us, and that then extended out into, you know, we became good friends. Sort of, again, work hard through the day and then kind of enjoy Johannesburg in the evenings and on weekends. We stayed in touch, you know, when we're both back in the UK. And the Virgin Group put Mark in touch with a young Scottish entrepreneur. He was a former corporate lawyer who had set up a gourmet soup business out of a van. And he was selling these soups just outside of Edinburgh University. And for each soup that he sold, he was doing a one-for-one concept called One Feeds Two, and he was donating a school meal for each soup that he was selling. And that was kind of the start. It was kind of the three of us kind of got put together, and it was, well, this is a really interesting idea. I guess the idea in itself is that, you know, it's really simple. It's that one-for-one concept of, you know, buy one, give one, or sell one, give one, in the case of our partners. And then at the core of it is that one is, it's a school meal, and the school meal's kind of, I'm sure we'll talk more about it, but it's just this incredible, it's an incredible thing to facilitate educational outcomes. It's so much more than just the meal, but even just the meal is such an important, in such an important thing on its own. And so, yeah, between the three of us, we realized that JP Campbell, who was the Scottish Guy with a Soup Van. So JP, Mark and I really worked on this idea of, okay, well, how can we take that one feeds two concept and how do we make it accessible to the whole food industry? Child hunger is a bigger issue than any one company can solve. So, you know, it makes sense that we kind of democratize it a little bit and package it up in a way that it's readily accessible to all sorts of different companies who operate in food. And really, so that was kind of the background to it, and that's sort of where it all kind of came from.
That's amazing. So over the last 10 years since the concept was founded, it's pretty much stayed the same. Am I right? The foundational principles of one feeds two or one cell one feed one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think and I think what's amazing is that so much of the beauty of it is in the simplicity. And you're right, actually, there's always the temptation to try new things, but actually a lot of what we've done over the years is kind of exercise the discipline of actually really what is this at the core, and actually how do we stick to that and just make sure that, you know, that really simple concept, which is really our nugget, that's preserved and not compromised in any way. When we bring on new partners, it's about, okay, how can we grow this movement, but also how do we make sure that the growth doesn't compromise what's already there? And over the years, we've made lots of choices that probably have meant slightly slower growth. But it's been, the general view's always been, well, actually let's build something that can last. And if we're going to feed some children, you know, a particular school today, let's make sure we can be there tomorrow to be feeding them again tomorrow, because just doing it once, that's not going to do anything. It's that school meal being reliably there day after day, that is the thing that will actually drive the outcomes that we're looking for.
This is super interesting for me because I suppose from a selfish point of view, I started Culinary Medicine, a nonprofit, a couple of years ago, which is an educational process by which we get dietitians, professional chefs and doctors to educate medical students and how to cook, as well as the foundations of nutrition. We're also applying that to medical professionals and graduates. And then we're also looking at upskilling in catering arenas as well. So chefs have the sort of foundational tools to create nutritious meals. But I guess going back to the listener, I imagine there are some people who have these like incredible ideas that are businesses for good, or they have initiatives or charity ideas that they want to start. And the one thing that really sticks out for me is the simplicity of the message, such that you can go to business and say that this is the concept and this is what we're doing. But I guess getting down to the nitty gritty, how you, JP and Mark, were able to start this as a side hustle until it kind of goes into something that you do full time. What were those sort of building blocks like?
I guess what one key part of One Feeds Two is that, so it's a charity rather than a business, and it continues to be the side hustle for all of us, and not really side hustle because it's the side passion project really, so each of us have our day jobs, and the day jobs pay the bill, and then this is what we do in and around that, and we've we you know, even as we've grown, I guess potentially we could look at ways of changing that, but actually at the end of the day, we want, it comes back to the simplicity, you know, it's quite a simple concept to explain to prospective partners. It's quite simple and easy for our partners to launch it and then to operate it on an ongoing basis. We don't have any ambitions of having a team of, you know, one feeds two employees, because actually we love the fact that this is lean and light. You know, it's very, very low cost to administer. You know, we genuinely want the funds that come in to end up in the hands of the people who are spending money on the school meals. At various points in time, we've definitely pretty much worked full time on it. And to be honest, we've kind of done that in points in time where we've been focusing on actually let's sort of invest the time in making it lean and light so that it doesn't require all of our time at other points. And then I guess it can't go without saying that we have been incredibly lucky with the number of people who sort of come out of the woodwork and offered to help us pro bono. We benefit from, on that front, from, you know, a branding and marketing agency, lawyers. We've had PR support, et cetera, et cetera. And in many ways, you know, technically the team is the three of us. In reality, all those people are every much as a part of the team as any of us are. And they've kind of alleviated the need for us to build a team out because, you know, touch wood, you know, that they'll continue in that vein, but, you know, the concept gets them and they like being a part of it.
I mean, that is super inspirational because, I mean, my incorrect impression was that you guys were doing the corporate thing and then you gradually turn this side passion, as you describe it, into something you do full time. And the fact that you have such an incredible mission, website and partners as well, and you're still doing this and it kind of looks after itself. I mean, that's pretty impressive because I think a lot of people who are listening who have ideas or charitable sort of innovations that could really help communities feel like, well, you have to drop everything else to focus on that. And I take your point that it does become like that in the early sort of beginnings, but to know that you can create something that you've created and it to essentially run by giving other people ownership of the project and clear sort of guidance on this is how the simple process works. That's really, really an achievement.
And I think we're lucky that our concept also lends itself quite well to that model as well. And then, as I mentioned before, it's just having some of that discipline to kind of keep it focused and on that nugget at the center of, which is, you know, really simple, clear concept, you know, reinforced by our name, which kind of says a lot about what it is that we do as well. And actually, you know, it may sound funny, but our logo, you know, it's the very, very clever, very clear, very positive thing. And, you know, I mean, it's such an asset to us. The logo gets people and says so much. And, you know, whether it's on one partner's menu or on pack or on their website or social media, it's been an extraordinary asset to us. Capturing who we are and what we're all about really imperfectly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Why don't you run us through the process of exactly how OneFeeds Two works, and in terms of, you know, how you work with brands, how you in the beginnings approached brands as well, I guess, with, you know, the sort of premise of what you're doing, and how that might have changed where you work with smaller brands today.
We partner with food brands. So we enter into a formal partnership, and that's very, it's very clearly set out, you know, that they are effectively licensing the OneFeeds Two concept on some of their, on the food or food that they're selling. And it's one for one. So, and from our side, for each meal that they sell, they will donate to us the cost of providing a school meal in one of the world's poorest countries. And so, you know, once we've agreed how that will work, and we've got our partnership in place, actually quite a bit of it is about, you know, each of the brands taking OneFeeds Two and reflecting that into their organization in a way that works for them. And, you know, if I look back over the years of running OneFeeds Two, that's been fascinating. Really, really, we've been so lucky to have partners who have completely different models from each other. They produce such different cuisines and sell in different ways, from kind of national restaurant chains to 100% online retailers to, you know, manufacturers of packaged food products through to recipe box companies. All of those differences have just been fascinating. And then also seeing how, you know, we've worked with brands as they've launched, but also really big established companies who you know, we've jumped on to be part of their story, you know, quite a few chapters in. And they all have different customer segments. They talk to their customers in very different ways. And so the way they talk about OneFeeds Two is really different as well. And so that's been amazing. I think the other thing is that, you know, OneFeeds Two is, it's you know, we've developed this to be an asset for our partners, something that, you know, it's really tangible that they can engage with, you know, and they engage with it alongside their customers, so that, you know, that, you know, really love the communications that our partners put out to their customers, because, you know, it's not OneFeeds Two kind of happens somewhere between a customer who chooses to buy a food product from that company and that company deciding to partner with us. And so, you know, from our perspective, we've never donated any school meals. It's been our partners, and our partners always, you know, right and rightly recognize that they're only doing that through the support of their customers. So it's this real kind of shared ownership of what we're trying to do. And it's amazing. And, you know, the reception that some of those communications get on social media and in places like that, you know, it's a concept that really resonates with a lot of people. I think a lot of people love the fact that they can make this really specific, tangible impact, and they can do it along with the thousand other things that they're doing in their day just by making a particular choice of what and who they buy from.
Totally. I think it really does tap in, particularly now, and this is why I think you guys are pioneers in this movement, this initiative, the charity that you started, into the conscious consumer, who are actively looking for things like B Corp certification, or their charitable partners, or what they are doing to tackle environmental change, climate change, global warming. You know, all these different things really do impact on a personal level my choices. Yes. And where I choose to spend my pound, because this is the most powerful voting tool that we have as a society. And what I love about One Feeds Two is, yes, the simplicity and the process by which me as a brand, or me as a national burger chain, or even a small company, can have and can communicate, yeah, as well to customers. It definitely demonstrates a commitment to change.
Mm. And I think that what we've been privileged to sort of get to see is how that commitment to something like One Feeds Two also really resonates within the employees in those partner organizations. Definitely. You know, I think it's again, it's that sort of tangible commitment to doing something good, and you know, that impact scales with the business as well. So there's a great alignment between doing good business in a good way and doing more of it. Positively reinforces on itself.
You made a conscious decision that you mentioned earlier about school meals in particular, and you know, the nutritional needs for young kids and the partner countries, I believe. Can you talk a bit about why you chose that particular meal and how you decide which areas that you're going to provide?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the school meal, it really is it's quite a magical thing. At the moment, there are over 30 million children who don't go to school because they either need to work, you know, beg, you know, scramble for food each day, and so their opportunities for education are sort of cut off at the knees, literally at the outset, and then beyond that, there's sort of more than 30 million other children who do go to school, but will go to school without having eaten anything, and who won't eat anything during that school day, and so the school meal itself it is really important, because obviously if a child's not eaten, there's the obvious need for the calories, the vitamins, etc., for them to kind of function, grow, develop, etc. And that's really important. On top of that, though, because it is a school meal and because it's provided at school, what happens is when a school starts offering a school meal program, enrollment levels go up, you know, attendance levels increase, and you know, no surprises, you know, the more kids are going to school, the better the educational outcomes are, and you know, it's quite an extraordinary kind of cause and effect, you know. And again, it's not rocket science, right? It's really simple, but you know, provide a nutritious meal to kids who otherwise wouldn't get it, and do it at school so they also get their education. It is pretty amazing, and when you're delivering school meals at scale, the unit costs you can bring the unit costs down very, very low. Typically the meals are plant-based, and you know, again, that just makes sense in terms of shelf life and preparation and all those sorts of things. The meals tend to be locally based, you know, based on the local cuisine as well, so it's the sort of thing that the children would be eating at home if the family had the means to provide that food. So it's not something unusual, frightening. It's again, it's really acting as the carrot to get kids into school, stay in school, And, you know, that school meal won't solve every problem. But if there's just one thing you can do, one lever you can pull, and you can try and have a big impact, like this is one we really want to be pulling. Fortunately, we've been fortunate enough to visit schools and see the communities. And I think for me, the thing that really strikes me always is you always go in looking forward to meeting the kids, seeing the school, seeing the meals being distributed and enjoyed and all those sorts of things. But the bit that always catches me is the sort of broader community. Before the pandemic, 2019, we were in Malawi and talking to sort of a local village chief, and his attitude that he described very eloquently was, you know, we view an educated child as an asset, and so, you know, he and the other elders in the village and parents were really invested in supporting the family, supporting as many children as possible to get into school. And I think that's where so much of the, you know, that's a really important part of the puzzle as well. You know, the recognition that education is a path to a better future. And then actually lots of people giving of their time to support that and, you know, to do everything that they can to get as many children into school. And
yeah.
And when the school meal is offered there, it makes their job, you know, they're doing it as much as they possibly can. This helps them so much, you know, this gives them an added, an added bow in their quiver for actually, and this is also why you should go to school, let's get the kids in there. Let's get that school meal into them. I love that side of it.
Yeah, I think that's really the crux of what appeals so much to me, I think, about the One Feeds Two charity. It's the fact that the food is associated with the educational attainment, that sort of that way of enticing the children to go to school. It's yes, you get a meal, but you're also actually creating educational wealth, a new generation of kids that are going to be more resilient, rather than a charity that's just providing a meal, which is equally as noble and, you know, incredible to do. I think the combination of the two, it being a school meal, I think is super, super powerful. And geographically, where do you decide to have your charitable donation?
Yeah, so the way that tends to work is, so we, as part of the work that we do, we've developed relationships with school feeding programs, so large charities whose kind of core operation is, you know, being in these countries, setting up the supply chains so that, you know, ideally locally sourced, locally grown and produced ingredients are then being processed, stored, transported, and then prepared fresh at school, and that's what they do. And I mean that's extraordinary work. I'm very happy to put my hand up and say that I have a much easier job than they do, and all credit to the way they managed to do that. And I think actually one of our partners, they managed to pivot their entire operation with the COVID lockdown from being centrally based around providing meals in schools to finding ways to provide meals to children who are now being homeschooled. And within, I think it was 1 or 2 months, they were providing as many meals to children who were being homeschooled as they were doing in schools beforehand, which is, I mean, just wow. jaw-dropping stuff, really. And so to answer your question about where in the world we fund, to be honest, what we do is we trust the school feeding programs to deploy those funds. That's honestly what they know, and they know relatively between one country and another where the greater need is. So on the whole, our model is to kind of not tie them, you know, when we're by no means large enough yet that we could ever be in a position where we're donating more than they could ever use in a particular country. Hopefully one day we get to that sort of scale, but we're happy to sort of give them that freedom and not tie them to something on the whole. And I say that because we do offer a bit of flexibility, because I think, for example, if we were talking to a chain of Vietnamese restaurants in the UK or the US, it would make sense that the founders might say, you know, we'd quite like it if the school meals we provided were in Vietnam or something similar for Mexican restaurant or whatever it happened to be. So that's something we can manage as well, because actually that adds to the story, that makes it additionally totally relevant to them. So we can do that as well.
Yeah, yeah. I just love the simplicity of it. And I know your operations have been responsible for, I think, is it over 8 million?
We're just about to announce 10. Donated? So, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Don't worry. It's one of those numbers that, 10 million. Okay. You know, our presentations are always, almost by definition, they're always out of date, because the second we update them, you know, another school week passes and the number goes up again. So,
I mean, that's literally like thousands every day. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, I know your operations are focused on poverty outside of the UK and the immediate needs, but during this year, obviously during the pandemic, I think for everyone it's been pretty shocking to understand how bad food insecurity was on our doorstep pre-pandemic. I remember we have a module in culinary medicine that we teach to the medical students all about food insecurity in the UK. And I think a lot of the students are quite shocked to hear about the millions of families that are reliant on food banks. And I wonder, given your perspective and your experience in this charitable world, what can we learn from One Feeds Two that we could potentially apply to our own societies today, and if you have sort of any guidance for food charities in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that's different. You know, I think it's probably worth saying up front, you know, immediately put my hands up and say, look, the UK is a very different place, and so there'll be very many, not just differences in nuance, but fundamental differences that the solution for the UK will need to be different to a One Feeds Two or even the model that our school feeding programs that we support adopt. I think some of the things that we see working that I do think translate from across countries are things like I described before about the the village chief and the elders and their value on education, their focus on it, and that really setting a tone. You know, I think that messaging and that being kind of part of the culture, you know, the kids know that, you know, how often they go and how well they do is important, and it's kind of the people checking up, you know. Kids will be kids, but, you know, also, you know, this isn't just something you go through the process and go through the motions on in terms of turning up to school. This is serious. It's a serious thing, and I mean, so many socioeconomic indicators are just so much better with as literacy levels increase. Just reading and writing skills just make such an extraordinary difference. And if you think that, you know, the young girl will one day be a mother and her ability to read a prescription and to read the label on some tablets and then kind of use those tablets correctly for their children to help with homework, to do the bookkeeping, to, you know, so just home economics, all those home economics things that will just be done in a better way. The people's ability to research options and, you know, make better choices just improves so much more. So I think there's definitely something about kind of community leaders and consistency and just the daily grind of repetition, you know, being consistent about, you know, this is what's really important, and long term this is the thing that's going to move the needle. I think the other thing that we see that's really extraordinary and heartwarming is the number of people who volunteer their time to support initiatives like this. So again, kind of referencing the trip to Malawi that we most recently did, you know, there was a lady there who walked 2 hours each morning to get to school in time to help prepare the school meals, stoke the fires, get the pots ready, carry the water, all that kind of thing. She didn't have children at the school, but she did that, you know, 5 days a week, and then tied it up at the end of the day and walked home again. And she kind of didn't get why we thought that was amazing, because, you know, to her it was just sort of, well, you know, this is such an important thing for this community. Why wouldn't I be doing this to contribute and to help? So she always sort of sticks out in our mind. And similarly, we had quite a lot of time with one of the senior teachers at the school, and he basically would turn up to work a couple of hours early each day to kind of oversee the operations. Again, because he could see the difference that the school meals made to the day that each child had, I mean, extraordinarily, we were talking to him about how many of the children would eat something other than that school meal. And at that point in time, we said 50% of the kids, for 50% of the kids, that would be their only meal. And he said, wow, actually, it gets much worse than that. As we get further away from the harvest and stores have been depleted, and you know, in that particular school, kind of 80-90% was not unheard of for the kids to only get that. So then your school meal goes from being something where you're supplementing the nutrition to being the only nutrition. But I think that whole community, that sort of sense of volunteering, of, you know, people getting involved, and doing little things, you know, some of them doing, you know, doing the extraordinary around, you know, the 2 hours each day. Other people whose lives can't accommodate that, but finding ways that they can support So around that particular school, they had a team of women, and basically their role was just to know where the kids were, how many kids there were, which ones were going to school, which ones weren't, and if there were children not going to school, to kind of rally around the family and kind of understand what some of the barriers were in place. So quite extraordinary sort of sense of community, and this kind of idea that, you know, sort of mindset, look, we're all in this together, and we'll all be better off if we can kind of give you a helping hand and kind of help you out. And they had incredible stories about, yeah, you know, the teachers would let them know if a child stopped coming to school, and they'd kind of pop around and just see, you know, what's changed, what's happened. You know, is there something there that as a community they can alleviate whatever that pressure is to help get that kid back to school as quickly as possible. Now, you know, I think there's probably a UK version of something like that that could be quite extraordinary as well.
Absolutely. I think, you know, now is the time to tap into this incredible sort of almost global culture of empathy. Everyone has never experienced the same suite of emotions at the same time ever, and I think in the history of humanity. So now I think is the time to sort of tap into that community sense of purpose, communal values sentiment to create initiatives like this. And you know what, there's probably a one feeds to concept in someone's mind, and hopefully someone listening to this as well, who wants to take action on it and start the process. And the fact that, you know, you've been able to do this on the side of your job, even though, you know, it's been your 100% job at some points in the past as well, you know, that's pretty inspirational. And there's a few people out there that I want to shine a spotlight on, actually, because they are doing some incredible things for UK based poverty and hunger and children in particular. But I think your experiences and those stories are super, super inspirational. What I want to ask as we close, I guess, is I suppose if there was, I mean, you've already achieved so much, so I feel a bit cheeky asking about what the moonshot might be for One Feeds Two, but let's say in another 10 years' time, what where would you hope One Feeds Two to be, and what sort of changes would you have hoped to inspire in either at a community level or even at a political or governmental level?
Look, I guess one part of the answer to that would be, a couple of years ago we extended our footprint to include the US as well. So we found three guys there with sort of similar sort of backgrounds and interests and also with day jobs, they were doing various roles in the food industry. And so we now have One Feeds Two USA, which is wonderful and really exciting. I think the future will hopefully include, you know, bigger versions of One Feeds Two in the UK and the US, but also hopefully in other countries and parts of the world. And we're doing some work at the moment on looking at some of those opportunities. Again, also doing it quite patiently, because we need to make sure that the extension doesn't compromise what's already there. And we also need to make sure that, you know, the extension works in that, you know, it's a simple concept, but actually make sure that simple concept can translate and can work in those other places as well. Look, I think in 10 years' time, you know, hopefully we can do another podcast, and hopefully the story is that, you know, that simple core of an idea is still that simple, is still the mainstay, and that's still what we are all about. But that we're doing it on a much, much bigger scale. You know, I've talked a bit about our partners and how varied they are. You know, what's been amazing is we've been able to kind of adapt this simple concept to work in really different business models within the food industry. We've got catering companies. I listed some of them before. You know, burger chains, recipe box companies, etc. But I think there's still other niches that we haven't had partners in, and you know, so much potential for us to have many partners in each of those niches as well. So I'm really excited about seeing, you know, how one feeds to, you know, we've never had a hotel partner, for example, or an airline partner. For me, they're like obvious places where this concept could find a really great home. And to be honest, the list does go on and on. You know, for me, I think over the next 10 years, it'd be really great to see how we can kind of build out our number of partners in more of these kind of different niches, and show that actually this simple concept can work and does deliver what customers, employees, and all various kind of stakeholders are looking for.
I mean, just the messaging and the fluidity, the sort of parallel, the there's so many concepts in the brand itself that just really, really do appeal to me. And even like what's on your website, Hunger to End Hunger, I just yes. Love sort of this. It just invokes so many emotions of community spirit. I mean you're such an inspirational character. The fact that you've done this with your partners and stuff, you must be working on some other entrepreneurial ambitions right now, I'm sure. I was going to ask, what has your day job been throughout this whole period? Has it changed? Have you still been in consultancy?
Or yeah. So, things, or so what, I think
what's that look like?
And yeah, the first couple of years were all consultancy. Working as management consultant. And then recently that's transitioned, as you suggest, to sort of more entrepreneurial endeavors. So, last year I launched a business called Found Drinks, and the concept is about, you know, looking at the refrigerator of drinks at a shopping centre, and you just kind of see a lot of tap water that should be free, wrapped in plastics and kind of dosed up with lots of sugar and artificial sweeteners, colours and preservatives. And so kind of found's been my kind of attempt to say, well, actually, let's go back to drinking the tap water, but we're people who like different flavors, and actually let's just sell the flavoring, but let's do it in a way that doesn't have any of the artificial ingredients, doesn't have the added sugar, and actually let's kind of make it as health promoting as possible. So we put vitamins, minerals, some really interesting botanicals into those as well. And I guess that the kind of thematic parallel between the two businesses was, you know, for me, the school meal was this amazing, magical thing you could do to drive educational outcomes in these developing countries. When I look at sort of food and drinks in somewhere like the UK or the US, you know, we all drink 6 to 8 times a day, and if even a couple of those drinks are either sort of quite badly polluting or not particularly healthy, you know, we're doing a lot of damage as a society across a lot of people that many tons every single day. And so in terms of, you know, kind of where to play and where to kind of try and do something that can make a big difference, this kind of, for me, felt like the one small change you could make to potentially have a big impact.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've been discussing some pretty hard-hitting subject matters on the podcast of late. Things like environmental and climate change, food insecurity is one, but also financial insecurity. Mm-hmm. So we had a conversation with George Monbiot and Professor Guy Standing about universal basic income, providing a layer of financial security. And that sort of concept has obviously heightened to become something that a lot of people are aware of now as a construct for society. But I think, you know, looking at the lens, and I know you've got some young children as well, perhaps that sort of lens of a parent has made us all a bit more conscious about the environment that we're leaving for our kids and grandkids going forward. And, you know, the entrepreneurial ambition that you have now with Fountrix, I think almost mirrors that. It's how do we create a healthier planet such that health is the default option and it thrives regardless of, you know, your ability to pay into wellness at a premium. And I think just looking at from an outsider, it seems that that might have had an influence.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think you're right. Actually, when you are a parent, you can't help but project forward and think you've got these younger lives who'll have many years beyond us. And yeah, absolutely about trying to do something. I guess part of it is, yeah, how do we end up with some better outcomes for that next generation? For me personally, it was also that a big part of it's been actually how can I show the kids that we can go from, you know, they can remember a time where this none of this existed. We didn't have a name for it, and we didn't have labels, and we didn't have recipes, and we didn't. And they can kind of see these things come together, and kind of to realize that, you know, businesses are built by normal people. You know, as much as they ever believe that their parents are normal people, but you know, it's just normal people having a crack. And so actually we've had some wonderful moments on a personal front of, you know, the kids doing taste testings and, you know, during lockdown, between kind of hours of homeschooling, you know, one of my sons coming up and, you know, kind of making website suggestions and, you know, I don't really think that's a good way to say it, Dad. How about we, I think... You're 9 years old. And he was right, of course.
He's a food brand consultant in the making.
that's a nuance to it as well. That it's an element that's been really important
to me. That's brilliant. I recently had a conversation with Professor Michael Garan and Dr. Ventura actually about sugar-sweetened beverages and the amount of sugar in kids' diets, and particularly how that impacts neurodevelopment and general development in kids. So, you know, welcoming any extra options there are to entice not only kids, but also, you know, the older generations that are reliant on sugar sweetened beverages to get through the day to have healthy options. So Fat Drink sounds like a fantastic initiative, and I can't wait to see what happens with One Feeds Two as well. It's a fantastic organization, and I hope to support in some way in the future.
That's great, Rupi. Thanks so much. I really do appreciate the support, and thanks for having us today.
Thank you so much for listening to the podcast today. Do check out Owen Burton's amazing initiative, One Feeds Two. The links to which are all on the website, thedoctorskitchen.com, and I will see you here to have more conversations with real impact.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.